Thanks.
So I guess we are all now having our gut microbiota working, but the question is whether that's still the only one type of microbiota which is working. And I don't have to recall to the audience the important role of metagenomic within the frame of metabolic disease, obviously. So, but to make a first statement, I think we kind of all agree on, certainly the change in nutrition and most likely the genetic environment altogether predispose the gut microbiota to change. And those factors that we could call the meta factors will trigger somehow several targets, including the immune system. And that could lead to what's been called a metabolic inflammation and metabolic disease targeting several sets of tissues around there, which are quite important for the control of glycemia or cardiovascular function. However, there's another player that has been proposed recently, which is related to, actually we heard about it this morning, bacterial translocation, which suggests that bacteria not only secrete factors, but could translocate as well into the body and establish what one could call quote-unquote, the tissue microbiota. And this is what basically could be at play, Raina, I'm going to try to convince you about, within the frame of metabolic disease. So whether on the top of gut microbiota, there's a tissue microbiota. So for that, the first row experiments we've done using adipose tissue, actually there was the stratosphere fractions from the adipose tissue from patients that were healthy, overweight, or obese, and we've just done a first round of pyrosequences, 16S pyrosequencing, getting plenty of bacteria, and we're very much surprised to see how diverse could be the amount of bacterial DNA, at least 16S bacterial DNA present in the adipose tissue of the human, the stratosphere fraction of the human adipose tissue. So based on that, we then figure out whether those bacterial DNA were just bacterial DNA period, or whether live bacteria were into play in the tissues. So the simple experiment was to get the tissues under very clean conditions, sterile condition, and ground the tissue and put it to grow on plates. And this is what we've got when we grew different set of tissues from either control of diabetic, those are mice tissues. And we were very much to our surprise, we did find plenty of colony forming units growing on plates in anaerobic condition. And we're very much surprised to see that indeed in high fadate-induced diabetes, there were some tissues with dramatic increase in number of colonies. So those suggested that indeed we do have alive bacteria in tissues, and in type 2 diabetic rodents, the amount of those bacteria dramatically increased, establishing somehow the quote-unquote tissue microbiota. So the key point afterwards was to figure out whether that tissue microbiota was similar between different animal models. So we compared mice fed a normal chow, a high-fat diet, and sequenced the microbiota, and compared the mice that were eating a high-fat diet but treated with a prebiotic to change the gut microbiota only. And that PCA, primary component analysis, does show that indeed the quality of the tissue microbiota was quite different with regard to the sequencing of the 16S rDNA. So basically, once that was established, we could ask several set of questions that I will come to. So to figure out whether that was meaningful or meaningless in terms of quantity of bacterial entities per cells, we did quantify the number of bacterial genomes per number of cells. And I know that my good friend Dushko is always asking me the question whether that makes sense or not. So after a while, I said that I should quantify that. And these are the data we get. So basically, in terms of number of bacterial DNA per in terms of mole of bacteria per cells, it's quite important. It's actually more than the number of cells that we have in our body. So there's more bacterial genome than eukaryotic cells per body. So that bacterial translocation suggests that the bacteria do get to the tissues somehow. And this is an example of a dendritic cell, so it's CD11C cells, within the adipose tissue, which is positive for a GFP-labeled bacteria that we provided to the mouse by GFH. And we can see these type of pictures plenty, very quite often, and that demonstrates that indeed we do have bacteria, at least within the immune cells within the tissues. So the key question is whether those bacteria have a role, bacterial DNA, bacterial proteins and factors, have a role in the control of metabolic disease or the given tissue, the quote-unquote infected tissues. And actually, when we perform the transcriptomic analysis and a taxonomic analysis, we can create here on that heat map bacteria taxons, at least the taxons, that were either negatively or positively positively correlated with different sets of genes. So we just have to uncover these genes and figure out who was targeted, who was in relationship with those bacterial DNA. So the relevant question we could ask first are, what are the molecular mechanisms responsible for that translocation? What are obviously the mechanisms responsible for the crosstalk with the given tissue? And could we define blood biomarkers related to these bacterial DNA factors? So for that, we've set up biotech company Viomer, which is dedicated to the study of bacterial DNA, and they've performed very nice sets of data and very beautiful work, and they can quantify the bacterial DNA of a given entity into the blood, either the overall entity or a given one, with very highly and reproducible sets of data. And out of that, for example, we could figure out, in a case control studies for the liver fibrosis, we could figure out a change in the concentration of bacterial DNA between cases and controls, and that was matching the score of the disease. So altogether, this is the first rock curve that came out of this type of study, and this has been improved by the quality of the sequencing itself. So altogether, the quantification of the bacterial DNA could be quite useful to validate a translocation of bacteria from the gut to the blood and from the blood to the tissue. But on the top, the quality of the DNA could be quite important to figure out and to sequence, so that can provide new biomarkers. So for that, we compare the human blood donors, just randomly picked up, from and water, obviously, as negative controls. And here are the sets, sorry, it's blur, but here are the sets of the bacteria that do belong to human blood, at least the bacterial DNA, the 16S. And when we plot a PC analysis, we can show that basically we separate, obviously, the negative control water with the different individuals. So we can characterize each individual by its own blood bacterial DNA, 16S. So with that in hand, we could confirm that there's a tissue microbe that exists. But what can control it? How does it get to the blood and to the tissue? So obviously the hypothesis that makes more sense was the hypothesis related to intestinal immunity. So we've heard about that this morning. We'll not get back too much to it. And the question is that out of all the different types of cells present in the intestinal barrier, some of them and the bacteria are under the control of bacteria, are those depicted here, which have been presented, published previously. So the question we had was whether in three different immune locations, such as the Peyer patches, the lamina propria, and the intraepithelial cells, the IEC cells, basically, there was a change during type 2 diabetes, high-fat diet-induced type 2 diabetes. So for that, we've fed mice a high-fat diet, and first we analyzed the different type of intestinal cytokines which were related to the changes in putative changes of the intestinal immune cells. And basically what we did found in control pre-diabetic and diabetic mice, we did find changes in several sets of cytokines in the ileum, the Peyer patches, but as well as in the mesenteric lymph node, but nothing so much drastically changed within the colon. So we did have several locations here with a dramatic change in some cytokines, including essentially IL-17 and IL-22 pathways. So these pathways was dramatically reduced in several locations within the small intestine. So the question is, which were the cells related to the change in cytokines? And obviously, the Th17 cells, or gamma T positive cells, were into play, because we did find in pre-diabetic and diabetic conditions a change in the frequency and the absolute numbers of IL-17 producing cells. But that was exactly the case with FOXP3. Very much to our surprise, there was a dramatic decrease in FOXP3, while conversely, Th1 interferon gamma positive cells were increased. So just to summarize the take-home message, that there is indeed a change in intestinal immunity of the small intestine, affecting essentially the lamina propria. We checked more carefully in the different other locations and couldn't find very clearly a change in such a phenotype. That was quite specific to the lamina propria of the small intestine, essentially the ileum. So whether there's a crosstalk, whether there's an impaired antigen-presenting cells that's tested ex vivo, so we get those cells, isolated the cells from the lamina propria, incubating those with LPS, which is a rigorous way to stimulate the production of cytokines that will help the T lymphocyte to maturate, the Th0 toward Th17. And again, we could find a reduction of IL-6 and IL-12 P40, suggesting that the Th1 and Th17 pathway might be altered because of a LAF, an impaired crosstalk with the APCs. So with that in mind, basically we would like to know whether that Th17 pathway that we could have picked up out of the Th1 as well, but we choose this one, I will say why afterwards, that was impaired in response to a high fat diet-induced type 2 diabetes. So thanks to Gérard Hébert, we got the ROR gamma T knockout mice. And we could show that if we just follow up the glycemia in response to a glucose challenge in those knockout mice, those mice just become spontaneously diabetic, at least glucose intolerance, and couldn't handle the glucose challenge. So in absence of ROR gamma T and Th17 pathways and IL-22 as well, there is an impaired glucose tolerance that occurs. So the mice are prone to become type 2 diabetic. So in order to demonstrate that was T lymphocytes and not, I will say, ILCs, we got splenocytes and we grafted those splenocytes, we transferred those splenocytes to a RAG1 mice and could show by adoptive transfer that we did transfer the phenotype just by the means of transferring the ROR gamma T splenocytes. So which suggests that indeed, in absence of ROR gamma T into the lymphocyte, there's an induction of type 2 diabetes. So what is at the origin of that intestinal ROR gamma T Th17 depletion, basically? So obviously, this is where microbiota comes into play. And we just pyrosequenced the bacterial DNA 16S, the taxons, from mice fed a high-fat diet for 1 week and 4 weeks, so pre-diabetic and diabetic. And the dendrogram shows that indeed it induces a very rapid change in the ileum microbiota. And when we treated a high-fat diet fed mice with a pre-probiotic, a specific symbiotic, we could induce a third metagenomic path profile, suggesting that we have here a tool to study not the impact of high-fat diet-induced type 2 diabetes, but the impact of a change of gut microbiota independent from the nutritional stress. And in such a condition, we could change the glycemia, but we could essentially change and restore the Th17, the FOXP3, and normalize the Th1 pathways. So out of that, the question was whether that is causal or just associated to. So we've set up a germ-free mice facility, and we transfer the ileum microbiota. This is not colonic or cecum or fecal. It's the ileum mucosal microbiota that has been transferred to germ-free mice in using the microbiota from a diabetic mouse or a diabetic mouse treated with the symbiotic. And in such a condition, we could improve the glucose tolerance, the glucose tolerance and prevent from the diabetic phenotype. So two take-home messages. The first one, that indeed, but we knew about that, gut microbiota can induce type 2 diabetes in germ-free mice. That's enough. However, on the top of that is the ileum microbiota, which is highly potent, involved in the transfer of the gut microbiota to induce type 2 diabetes. The second phenotype is certainly that if we treat with a symbiotic to change just the structure of the gut microbiota, the ileum microbiota, we can reverse dramatically well that phenotype. And the reversion of that phenotype was indeed associated with an increased Th17, an increased FASP3, and there was, for some reason that I still don't understand, some kind of increased Th1 interferon gamma positive cells. So basically, out of that, we could demonstrate somehow that the gut microbiota, at least the ileum mucosal microbiota, is responsible for high fat diet induced diabetes and probably affect the IL-17, FOXP3, so the Th17, FOXP3 pathways, and I will explain afterwards why, not Th1. So, which are the bacteria that could be associated with or responsible for? We went further into the sequencing, and to make a very long story short, we picked up a couple of bacterial candidates here, the Porphyromonadaceae, that were altered, impaired by the dietary treatment, 30 days of one. So 1 month of high-fat diet, and that were reversed by the treatment here, the symbiotic treatment. Other groups of bacteria were following more or less the same pictures, and others were following an inverse pictures. So that impaired intestinal microbiota, and again, it's mucosal ileal microbiota, alters the immune system and favors type 2 diabetes. So a major question now is to figure out whether there are some kind of consequences, metabolic and physiological consequences of that change in the gut microbiota and in the tissue microbiota, which are the gene altered. So for that, we first analyzed whether the impaired intestinal immune system was associated with a change in mucosal microbiota. We knew that, but in mucosal adherence of the microbiota. So we quantified in different segments of the intestine the bacteria by the use of a GFP E. coli bacteria, and we can see a strong increase in bacterial adherence following the pre-diabetic stage, just 1 week of high-fat diet. So that was the first phenotype we could observe. And the second one, as I just mentioned, was the change in intestinal mucosal microbiota. So an increased bacterial adherence. So again, we asked the question, which were the genes related to that? So we decided to target the adipose tissue because it's easy, it's plenty of bacteria, and so on. It's important for metabolic disease. So we sequenced the tissue microbiota, and we analyzed the gene expression. So that's just a little setup of key genes that we did find out in those microarray and metagenomic analysis, adipose tissue metagenomics. Again, it's adipose tissue metagenomic and adipose tissue microarray within the same mouse. So we picked up several candidates, and out of those candidates, the NOD1 and NOD2 came out strong, and they make a lot of sense because they are involved in the recognition of the peptidoglycans. So we decided to focus our attention on these receptors, and thanks to a collaboration with Philippe Sansonetti, we got the corresponding knockout mice, the NOD1 and NOD2 mice, and we challenged these mice with a high-fat diet to see whether those two knockouts could resist the occurrence of type 2 diabetes. And the only one that was resisting the impact of type 2 diabetes were the NOD1. So the NOD1 mice fed a high-fat diet as absolutely normal tolerant to glucose, while the NOD2 were either equally glucose intolerant or even more glucose intolerant, more prone to be diabetic. So it seems that NOD1 was favoring high-fat diet-induced type 2 diabetes, and if we get rid of NOD1, the type 2 diabetes did not occur. So we afterwards validated that indeed in mesenteric adipose tissue in response to a high-fat diet, in absence of NOD1, the amount of bacterial DNA amount was strongly reduced, suggesting that the bacterial translocation and the targeting of the adipose tissue by bacteria will require NOD1 to carry over the bacteria, to recognize the bacteria, and to declench the immune reactions by inducing that tissue microbiota. A key question that we did ask at that time with Philippe Sansonetti was to figure out whether the bacteria itself was important, whether we could alter the way that bacteria could be recognized. So for that, we've isolated an E. coli from the gut microbiota that we use to manipulate. And Julian Nigro in Philip's lab set up this quite important mutant here. And it's a mutant within the structure of the peptidoglycan, which basically is not as well recognized by the NOD receptors. So it's kind of quote-unquote blind to the NOD receptors and to the immune cells, which are important for the recognition of the bacterial DNA. So when we gavage a mouse with that E. coli, that's a wild-type E. coli, we get a few, you don't see from the back, I guess, you get a few E. coli within the small square fraction of the adipose tissue here analyzed by FACS, because that's a regular mouse, it's a healthy mouse. There is no reason why. However, if we do the same thing with the mutant E. coli, which is quote-unquote blind to the NOD receptors, we do dramatically accumulate cells from the small square fractions, which are GFP co-labeled, so demonstrating that the E. coli goes from the gut toward the adipose tissue, and this is roughly within 2 to 4 hours. So it's a very dynamic event that occurs quite rapidly, and that requires a full recognition by the NOD system to get rid of that. So out of that, we could suggest that on the top of the bacterial receptors, such as NOD and TLRs and so on, the structure of the bacteria itself is quite important. So the peptidoglycan needs to be recognized by the immune system to prevent or to control, according to the case, the translocation of the bacterial fragment and the bacteria itself. Whether it degrades afterwards the bacteria to kill the bacteria, this is another immune-related issue. So to make a long story short, what we could propose is that upon a change of food intake, there's a change of gut microbiota, and given sets of bacterial factors, including alive bacteria, peptidoglycan, LPS, plenty of metafactors that we've just heard from Elaine, and those factors could trigger directly within the tissue, adipose, leisure, skeletal muscle, and so on, directly within the tissue could trigger some genes that will control the phenotype of those tissues and probably lead to metabolic inflammation and then to adipose tissue development, hepatic steatosis, insulin resistance, and so on. We could pinpoint that the intestinal defense is quite important. We've heard about that this morning. And we did find that the presence of Th17 cells is mandatory to prevent the bacterial translocation. So those Th17 cells are protecting. This is quite difficult to say that in front of people that are working on intestinal bowel disease, where it's supposed to be deleterious for the health. But over here, it does protect against high fat diet induced type 2 diabetes. And then bacterial determinant could be used as biomarkers as well as bacterial DNA. And obviously, some genes can be discovered that control the metabolic phenotype. So we have kind of an overall physiological picture over here that suggests that the gut microbiota to adipose tissue relationship would require, obviously, intestinal immune system, some bacterial factors, and the crosstalk was targeted genes. So with that, I'd like to thank the people who've done the job. So we have some immunology people here, Céline Pommier and Lucie Garidou, as well as Pascal Klopp, and plenty of people from the lab did participate, including Anaïs Giry and Matteo Cirino for the germ-free mice, the bioinformatic plateau here that helped us to figure out what's the heck going on with the 16S and so on, and several members, key members from our partners. I thank you for your attention.